tout putain vous trouverez. These verses are but a coarser expression of the slanderous line of Pope, that every woman is at heart a rake. This naturally gave great offence, and being perceived one day in the king's antechamber by some ladies who were waiting for an audience, they resolved to punish him. To the number of 10 or 12 they armed themselves with canes and rods, and, surrounding the unlucky poet, called upon the gentlemen present to strip him naked, that they might wreak just vengeance upon him and lash him through the streets of the town. Some of the lords present were in no wise loath, and promised themselves great sport from his punishment. But Jean de Meung was unmoved by their threats, and stood up calmly in the midst of them, begging them to hear him first, and then, if not satisfied, they might do as they liked with him. Silence being restored, he stood upon a chair and entered on his defense. He acknowledged that he was the author of the obnoxious verses, but denied that they bore reference to all womankind. He only meant to speak of the vicious and abandoned, whereas those whom he saw around him were patterns of virtue, loveliness, and modesty. If, however, any lady present thought herself aggrieved, he would consent to be stripped, and she might lash him till her arms were weary. It is added that by this means Jean escaped his flogging, and that the wrath of the fair ones immediately subsided. The gentlemen present were, however, of opinion that if every lady in the room whose character corresponded with the verses had taken him at his word, the poet would in all probability have been beaten to death. All his life long he evinced a great animosity towards the priesthood, and his famous poem abounds with passages reflecting upon their avarice, cruelty, and immorality. At his death he left a large box filled with some weighty material, which he bequeathed to the Cordeliers as a peace offering for the abuse he had lavished upon them. As his practice of alchemy was well known, it was thought that the box was filled with gold and silver, and the Cordeliers congratulated each other on their rich acquisition. When it came to be opened, they found to their horror that it was filled only with slates, scratched with hieroglyphic and cabalistic characters. Indignant at the insult, they determined to refuse him Christian burial on pretense that he was a sorcerer. He was, however, honorably buried in Paris, the whole court attending his funeral. Nicolas Flamel. The story of this alchemist, as handed down by tradition and enshrined in the pages of Longlet de Frenois, is not a little marvelous. He was born at Pontoise, of a poor but respectable family, at the end of the 13th or beginning of the 14th century. Having no patrimony, he set out for Paris at an early age to try his fortune as a public scribe. He had received a good education, was well skilled in the learned languages, and was an excellent penman. He soon procured occupation as a letter writer and copyist, and used to sit at the corner of the Rue de Marivaux and practice his calling. But he hardly made profit enough to keep body and soul together. To mend his fortunes, he tried poetry, but this was a more wretched occupation still. As a transcriber, he at least gained bread and cheese, but his rhymes were not worth a crust. He then tried painting with as little success, and as a last resource, began to search for the philosopher's stone and tell fortunes. This was a happier idea. He soon increased in substance, and had wherewithal to live comfortably. He therefore took unto himself his wife, Petronella, and began to save money, but continued to all outward appearance as poor and miserable as before. In the course of a few years he became desperately addicted to the study of alchemy, and thought of nothing but the philosopher's stone, the elixir of life, and the universal alkahest. In the year 1257 he bought by chance an old book for 2 florins, which soon became his sole study. It was written with a steel instrument upon the bark of trees, and contained 21, or as he himself always expressed it, 3 times 7 leaves. The writing was very elegant and in the Latin language. Each 7th leaf contained a picture and no writing. On the 1st of these was a serpent swallowing rods, on the 2nd a cross with a serpent crucified, and on the 3rd the representation of a desert in the midst of which was a fountain with serpents crawling from side to side. It purported to be written by no less a personage than Abraham, patriarch, Jew, prince, philosopher, priest, Levite, and astrologer, and invoked curses upon anyone who should cast eyes upon it, without being a sacrificer or a scribe. Nicholas Flamel never thought it extraordinary that Abraham should have known Latin, and was convinced that the characters on his book had been traced by the hands of that great patriarch himself. He was at first afraid to read it after he became aware of the curse it contained, but he got over that difficulty by recollecting that, although he was not a sacrificer, he had practiced as a scribe. As he read, he was filled with admiration and found that it was a perfect treatise upon the transmutation of metals. All the processes were clearly explained: the vessels, the retorts, the mixtures, and the proper times and seasons for experiment. But as ill luck would have it, the possession of the Philosopher's Stone, or prime agent in the work, was presupposed. This was a difficulty which was not to be got over. It was like telling a starving man how to cook a beefsteak instead of giving him the money to buy one. But Nicholas did not despair, and set about studying the hieroglyphics and allegorical representations with which the book abounded. He soon convinced himself that it had been one of the sacred books of the Jews, and that it was taken from the Temple of Jerusalem on its destruction by Titus. The process of reasoning by which he arrived at this conclusion is not stated. For some expression in the treatise, he learned that the allegorical drawings on the fourth and fifth leaves enshrined the secret of the Philosopher's Stone, without which all the fine Latin of the directions was utterly unavailing. He invited all the alchemists and learned men of Paris to come and examine them, but they all departed as wise as they came. Nobody could make anything either of Nicholas or his pictures, and some even went so far as to say that his invaluable book was not worth a farthing. This was not to be borne, and Nicholas resolved to discover the great secret by himself, without troubling the philosophers. He found on the first page of the fourth leaf the picture of Mercury attacked by an old man resembling Saturn or Time. The latter had an hourglass on his head and in his hand a scythe, with which he aimed a blow at Mercury's feet. The reverse of the leaf represented a flower growing on a mountaintop, shaken rudely by the wind, with a blue stalk, red and white blossoms, and leaves of pure gold. Around it were a great number of dragons and griffins. On the first page of the fifth leaf was a fine garden, in the midst of which was a rose tree in full bloom, supported against the trunk of a gigantic oak. At the foot of this there bubbled up a fountain of milk-white water, which, forming a small stream, flowed through the garden and was afterwards lost in the sands. On the second page was a king, with a sword in his hand, superintending a number of soldiers, who, in execution of his orders, were killing a great multitude of young children, spurning the prayers and tears of their mothers, who tried to save them from destruction. The blood of the children was carefully collected by another party of soldiers and put into a large vessel, in which two allegorical figures of the sun and moon were bathing themselves. For 21 years, poor Nicholas wearied himself with the study of these pictures, but still he could make nothing of them. His wife Petronella at last persuaded him to find out some learned rabbi, but there was no rabbi in Paris learned enough to be of any service to him. The Jews met but small encouragement to fix their abode in France, and all the chiefs of that people were located in Spain. To Spain, accordingly, Nicholas Flamel repaired. He left his book in Paris, for fear perhaps that he might be robbed of it on the road. And telling his neighbors that he was going on a pilgrimage to the shrine of St. James of Compostela, he trudged on foot towards Madrid in search of a rabbi. He was absent 2 years in that country and made himself known to a great number of Jews, descendants of those who had been expelled from France in the reign of Philip Augustus. The believers in the Philosopher's Stone give the following account of his adventures. They say that at Lyon he made the acquaintance of a converted Jew named Koch, a very learned physician, to whom he explained the title and nature of his little book. The doctor was transported with joy as soon as he heard it named, and immediately resolved to accompany Nicholas to Paris, that he might have a sight of it. The two set out together, the doctor on the way entertaining his companion with the history of his book, which, if the genuine book he thought it to be, from the description he had heard of it, was in the handwriting of Abraham himself, and had been in the possession of personages no less distinguished than Moses, Joshua, Solomon, and Esdras. It contained all the secrets of alchemy and of many other sciences, and was the most valuable book that had ever existed in this world. The doctor was himself no mean adept, and Nicholas profited greatly by his discourse, as in the garb of poor pilgrims they wended their way to Paris, convinced of their power to turn every old shovel in that capital into pure gold. But unfortunately, when they reached Orléans, the doctor was taken dangerously ill. Nicholas watched by his bedside and acted the double part of a physician and nurse to him, but he died after a few days, lamenting with his last breath that he had not lived long enough to see the precious volume. Nicholas rendered the last honors to his body, and with a sorrowful heart and not one sou in his pocket, proceeded home to his wife, Petronella. He immediately recommenced the study of his pictures, but for 2 whole years he was as far from understanding them as ever. At last, in the 3rd year, a glimmer of light stole over his understanding. He recalled some expression of his friend, the doctor, which had hitherto escaped his memory, and he found that all his previous experiments had been conducted on a wrong basis. He recommenced them now with renewed energy, and at the end of the year had the satisfaction to see all his toils rewarded. On the 13th of January 1382, says Longley, he made a projection on mercury and had some very excellent silver. On the 25th of April following, he converted a large quantity of mercury into gold, and the great secret was his. Nicholas was now about 80 years of age and still a hale and stout old man. His friends say that by a simultaneous discovery of the elixir of life, he found means to keep death at a distance for another 1/4 of a century, and that he died in 1415, at the age of 116. In this interval he made immense quantities of gold, though to all outward appearance he was as poor as a mouse. At an early period of his changed fortune he had, like a worthy man, taken counsel from his old wife Petronella as to the best use he could make of his wealth. Petronella replied that, as unfortunately they had no children, the best thing he could do was to build hospitals and endow churches. Nicholas thought so too, especially when he began to find that his elixir could not keep off death, and that the grim foe was making rapid advances upon him. He richly endowed the church of Saint-Jacques de la Boucherie, near the Rue de Marivaux, where he had all his life resided, besides 7 others in different parts of the kingdom. He also endowed 14 hospitals and built 3 chapels. The fame of his great wealth and his munificent benefactions soon spread over all the country, and he was visited, among others, by the celebrated doctors of that day, Jean Gerson, Jean de Courtecuisse, and Pierre d'Ailly. They found him in his humble apartment, meanly clad, and eating porridge out of an earthen vessel, and with regard to his secret, as impenetrable as all his predecessors in alchemy. His fame reached the ears of the king, Charles VI, who sent Monsieur de Cramoisy, the master of requests, to find out whether Nicholas had indeed discovered the philosopher's stone. But Monsieur de Cramoisy took nothing by his visit. All his attempts to sound the alchemist were unavailing, and he returned to his royal master no wiser than he came. It was in this year, 1414, that he lost his faithful Petronella. He did not long survive her, but died in the following year and was buried with great pomp by the grateful priests of Saint-Jacques de la Boucherie. The great wealth of Nicholas Flamel is undoubted, as the records of several churches and hospitals in France can testify. That he practiced alchemy is equally certain, as he left behind several works upon the subject. Those who knew him well and who were incredulous about the philosopher's stone give a satisfactory solution of the secret of his wealth. They say that he was always a miser and a usurer, that his journey to Spain was undertaken with very different motives from those pretended by the alchemists, that in fact he went to collect debts due from Jews in that country to their brethren in Paris, and that he charged a commission of fully 10% in consideration of the difficulty of collecting and the dangers of the road, that when he possessed thousands he lived upon almost nothing, and was the general moneylender at enormous profits to all the dissipated young men at the French court. Among the works written by Nicholas Flamel on the subject of alchemy is The Philosophic Summary, a poem reprinted in 1735 as an appendix to the third volume of the Roman de la Rose. He also wrote three treatises upon natural philosophy and an alchemic allegory entitled Le Désir Désiré. Specimens of his writing and a facsimile of the drawings in his Book of Abraham may be seen in Salmon's Bibliothèque des Philosophes Chimiques. The writer of the article Flamel in the Biographie Universelle says that for 100 years after the death of Flamel, many of the adepts believed that he was still alive, that he would live for upwards of 600 years. The house he formerly occupied at the corner of the Rue de Marivaux has been often taken by credulous speculators and ransacked from top to bottom, in the hopes that gold might be found. A report was current in Paris not long previous to the year 1816, that some lodgers had found in the cellars several jars filled with a dark-colored ponderous matter. Upon the strength of the rumor, a believer in all the wondrous tales told of Nicolas Flamel bought the house and nearly pulled it to pieces in ransacking the walls and wainscoting for hidden gold. He got nothing for his pains, however, and had a heavy bill to pay to restore his dilapidations. George Ripley. While alchemy was thus cultivated on the continent of Europe, it was not neglected in the Isles of Britain. Since the time of Roger Bacon, it had fascinated the imagination of many ardent men in England. In the year 1404, an act of Parliament was passed declaring the making of gold and silver to be a felony. Great alarm was felt at that time lest any alchemist should succeed in his projects, and perhaps bring ruin upon the state by furnishing boundless wealth to some designing tyrant who would make use of it to enslave his country. This alarm appears to have soon subsided, for in the year 1455, King Henry VI, by advice of his council and Parliament, granted 4 successive patents and commissions to several knights, citizens of London, chemists, monks, mass priests, and others to find out the philosopher's stone and elixir, to the great benefit, said the patent, of the realm, and the enabling of the king to pay all the debts of the crown in real gold and silver. Prynne, in his Aurum Regine, observes as a note to this passage that the king's reason for granting this patent to ecclesiastics was that they were such good artists in transubstantiating bread and wine in the Eucharist, and therefore the more likely to be able to effect the transmutation of baser metals into better. No gold, of course, was ever made, and the next year the king, doubting very much of the practicability of the thing, took further advice and appointed a commission of 10 learned men and persons of eminence to judge and certify to him whether the transmutation of metals were a thing practicable or no. It does not appear whether the commission ever made any report upon the subject. In the succeeding reign, an alchemist appeared who pretended to have discovered the secret. This was George Ripley, the canon of Bridlington in Yorkshire. He studied for 20 years in the universities of Italy and was a great favorite with Pope Innocent VIII, who made him one of his domestic chaplains, and master of ceremonies in his household. Returning to England in 1477, he dedicated to King Edward IV his famous work, The Compound of Alchemy, or The 12 Gates Leading to the Discovery of the Philosopher's Stone. These gates he described to be calcination, solution, separation, conjunction, putrefaction, congelation, cibation, sublimation, fermentation, exaltation, multiplication, and projection, to which he might have added botheration, the most important process of all. He was very rich and allowed it to be believed that he could make gold out of iron. Fuller, in his Worthies of England, says that an English gentleman of good credit reported that in his travels abroad he saw a record in the island of Malta which declared that Ripley gave yearly to the knights of that island and of Rhodes the enormous sum of £100,000 sterling, to enable them to carry on the war against the Turks. In his old age he became an anchorite near Boston, and wrote 25 volumes upon the subject of alchemy, the most important of which is the Duodecim Portarum, already mentioned. Before he died, he seems to have acknowledged that he had misspent his life in this vain study, and requested that all men, when they met with any of his books, would burn them or afford them no credit, as they had been written merely from his opinion and not from proof, and that subsequent trial had made manifest to him that they were false and vain. Basil Valentine. Germany also produced many famous alchemists in the 15th century, the chief of whom are Basil Valentine, Bernard of Treves, and the abbot Trithemius. Basil Valentine was born at Mayence and was made prior of St. Peter's at Erfurt about the year 1414. It was known during his life that he diligently sought the philosopher's stone, and that he had written some works upon the process of transmutation. They were thought for many years to be lost, but were, after his death, discovered enclosed in the stone work of one of the pillars in the abbey. They were 21 in number, and are fully set forth in the third volume of Longley's History of the Hermetic Philosophy. The alchemists asserted that heaven itself conspired to bring to light these extraordinary works, and that the pillar in which they were enclosed was miraculously shattered by a thunderbolt, and that as soon as the manuscripts were liberated, the pillar closed up again of its own accord. Bernard of Treves. The life of this philosopher is a remarkable instance of talent and perseverance misapplied. In the search of his chimera, nothing could daunt him. Repeated disappointment never diminished his hopes, and from the age of 14 to that of 85, he was incessantly employed among the drugs and furnaces of his laboratory, wasting his life with the view of prolonging it, and reducing himself to beggary in the hopes of growing rich. He was born at either Treves or Padua in the year 1406. His father is said by some to have been a physician in the latter city, and by others to have been Count of the Marches of Treves, and one of the most wealthy nobles of his country. At all events, whether noble or physician, he was a rich man, and left his son a magnificent estate. At the age of 14, he first became enamored of the science of alchemy, and read the Arabian authors in their own language. He himself has left a most interesting record of his labors and wanderings, from which the following particulars are chiefly extracted. The first book which fell into his hands was that of the Arabian philosopher Rhazes, from the reading of which he imagined that he had discovered the means of augmenting gold a hundredfold. For 4 years he worked in his laboratory with the book of Rhazes continually before him. At the end of that time, he found that he had spent no less than 800 crowns upon his experiment, and had got nothing but fire and smoke for his pains. He now began to lose confidence in Rhazes, and turned to the works of Geber. He studied him assiduously for 2 years, and, being young, rich, and credulous, was beset by all the alchemists of the town, who kindly assisted him in spending his money. He did not lose his faith in Geber, or patience with his hungry assistants, until he had lost 2,000 crowns, a very considerable sum in those days. Among all the crowd of pretended men of science who surrounded him, there was but one as enthusiastic and as disinterested as himself. With this man, who was a monk of the Order of St. Francis, he contracted an intimate friendship, and spent nearly all his time. Some obscure treatises of Rupa Sissa and Sacrobosco having fallen into their hands, they were persuaded from reading them that highly rectified spirits of wine was the universal alkahest, or dissolvent, which would aid them greatly in the process of transmutation. They rectified the alcohol 30 times, till they made it so strong as to burst the vessels which contained it. After they had worked 3 years, and spent 300 crowns in the liquor, they discovered that they were on the wrong track. They next tried alum and copperas, but the great secret still escaped them. They afterwards imagined that there was a marvelous virtue in all excrement, especially the human, and actually employed more than 2 years in experimentalizing upon it with mercury, salt, and molten lead. Again the adepts flocked around him from far and near to aid him with their counsels. He received them all hospitably, and divided his wealth among them so generously and unhesitatingly that they gave him the name of the Good Trevisan, by which he is still often mentioned in works that treat on alchemy. For 12 years he led this life, making experiments every day upon some new substance, and praying to God night and morning that he might discover the secret of transmutation. In this interval he lost his friend the monk, and was joined by a magistrate of the city of Treves, as ardent as himself in the search. His new acquaintance imagined that the ocean was the mother of gold, and that sea salt would change lead or iron into the precious metals. Bernard resolved to try, and, transporting his laboratory to a house on the shores of the Baltic, he worked upon salt for more than a year, melting it, sublimating it, crystallizing it, and occasionally drinking it, for the sake of other experiments. Still, the strange enthusiast was not wholly discouraged, and his failure in one trial only made him the more anxious to attempt another. He was now approaching the age of 50 and had as yet seen nothing of the world. He therefore determined to travel through Germany, Italy, France, and Spain. Wherever he stopped, he made inquiries whether there were any alchemists in the neighborhood. He invariably sought them out, and if they were poor, relieved, and if affluent, encouraged them. At Citeaux, he became acquainted with one Geoffrey Levier, a monk of that place, who persuaded him that the essence of eggshells was a valuable ingredient. He tried, therefore, what could be done, and was only prevented from wasting a year or two on the experiment by the opinions of an attorney at Bergam in Flanders, who said that the great secret resided in vinegar and copperas. He was not convinced of the absurdity of this idea until he had nearly poisoned himself. He resided in France for about 5 years when, hearing accidentally that one Master Henry, confessor to the Emperor Frederick III, had discovered the Philosopher's Stone, he set out for Germany to pay him a visit. He had, as usual, surrounded himself with a set of hungry dependents, several of whom determined to accompany him. He had not heart to refuse them, and he arrived at Vienna with 5 of them. Bernard sent a polite invitation to the confessor and gave him a sumptuous entertainment, at which were present nearly all the alchemists of Vienna. Master Henry frankly confessed that he had not discovered the Philosopher's Stone, but that he had all his life been employed in searching for it, and would so continue till he found it or died. This was a man after Bernard's own heart, and they vowed with each other an eternal friendship. It was resolved at supper that each alchemist present should contribute a certain sum towards raising 42 marks of gold, which in 5 days, it was confidently asserted by Master Henry, would increase in his furnace 5-fold. Bernard, being the richest man, contributed the lion's share, 10 marks of gold, Master Henry 5, and the others 1 or 2 apiece, except the dependents of Bernard who were obliged to borrow their quota from their patron. The grand experiment was duly made. The golden marks were put into a crucible with a quantity of salt, copperas, aquafortis, eggshells, mercury, lead, and dung. The alchemists watched this precious mess with intense interest, expecting that it would agglomerate into one lump of pure gold. At the end of 3 weeks they gave up the trial upon some excuse that the crucible was not strong enough or that some necessary ingredient was wanting. Whether any thief had put his hands into the crucible is not known, but it is alleged that the gold found therein at the close of the experiment was worth only 16 marks instead of the 42 which were put there at the beginning. Bernard, though he made no gold at Vienna, made away with a very considerable quantity. He felt the loss so acutely that he vowed to think no more of the Philosopher's Stone. This wise resolution he kept for 2 months, but he was miserable. He was in the condition of the gambler who cannot resist the fascination of the game while he has a coin remaining, but plays on with the hope of retrieving former losses till hope forsakes him and he can live no longer. He returned once more to his beloved crucibles and resolved to prosecute his journey in search of a philosopher who had discovered the secret and would communicate it to so zealous and persevering an adept as himself. From Vienna he traveled to Rome, and from Rome to Madrid. Taking ship at Gibraltar, he proceeded to Messina, from Messina to Cyprus, from Cyprus to Greece, from Greece to Constantinople, and thence into Egypt, Palestine, and Persia. These wanderings occupied him about 8 years. From Persia he made his way back to Messina, and from thence into France. He afterwards passed over into England, still in search of his great chimera, and this occupied 4 years more of his life. He was now growing both old and poor, for he was 62 years of age and had been obliged to sell a great portion of his patrimony to provide for his expenses. His journey to Persia had cost upwards of 13,000 crowns, about one half of which had been fairly melted in his all-devouring furnaces. The other half was lavished upon the sycophants that he made it his business to search out in every town he stopped at. On his return to Treves, he found, to his sorrow, that, if not an actual beggar, he was not much better. His relatives looked upon him as a madman and refused even to see him. Too proud to ask for favors from anyone, and still confident that some day or other he would be the possessor of unbounded wealth, he made up his mind to retire to the island of Rhodes, where he might, in the meantime, hide his poverty from the eyes of the world. Here he might have lived unknown and happy, but as ill luck would have it, he fell in with a monk as mad as himself upon the subject of transmutation. They were, however, both so poor that they could not afford to buy the proper materials to work with. They kept up each other's spirits by learned discourses on the Hermetic philosophy, and in the reading of all the great authors who had written upon the subject. Thus did they nurse their folly, as the good wife of Tam-O-Shanter did her wrath, to keep it warm. After Bernard had resided about a year in Rhodes, a merchant who knew his family advanced him the sum of 8,000 florins upon the security of the last remaining acres of his formerly large estate. Once more provided with funds, he recommenced his labors with all the zeal and enthusiasm of a young man. For 3 years he hardly stepped out of his laboratory. He ate there and slept there, and did not even give himself time to wash his hands and clean his beard, so intense was his application. It is melancholy to think that such wonderful perseverance should have been wasted in so vain a pursuit, and that energies so unconquerable should have had no worthier field to strive in. Even when he had fumed away his last coin and had nothing left in prospective to keep his old age from starvation, hope never forsook him. He still dreamed of ultimate success, and sat down, a gray-headed man of 80, to read over all the authors on the Hermetic mysteries, from Geber to his own day, lest he should have misunderstood some process which it was not yet too late to recommence. The alchemists say that he succeeded at last and discovered the secret of transmutation in his 82nd year. They add that he lived 3 years afterwards to enjoy his wealth. He lived, it is true, to this great age, and made a valuable discovery, more valuable than gold or gems. He learned, as he himself informs us, just before he had attained his 83rd year, that the great secret of philosophy was contentment with our lot. Happy it would have been for him if he had discovered it sooner, and before he became decrepit, a beggar and an exile. He died at Rhodes in the year 1490, and all the alchemists of Europe sang elegies over him, and sounded his praise as the good Trevisan. He wrote several treatises upon his chimera, the chief of which are the Book of Chemistry, the Verbum Dimissum, and an essay, De Natura Ovi. Trithemius. The name of this eminent man has become famous in the annals of alchemy, although he did but little to gain so questionable an honor. He was born in the year 1462 at the village of Trittheim, in the electorate of Treves. His father was John Heidenberg, a vine grower, in easy circumstances, who, dying when his son was but 7 years old, left him to the care of his mother. The latter married again very shortly afterwards, and neglected the poor boy, the offspring of her first marriage. At the age of 15, he did not even know his letters, and was, besides, half-starved, and otherwise ill-treated by his stepfather. But the love of knowledge germinated in the breast of the unfortunate youth, and he learned to read at the house of a neighbor. His father-in-law set him to work in the vineyards, and thus occupied all his days, but the nights were his own. He often stole out unheeded when all the household were fast asleep, poring over his studies in the fields by the light of the moon, and thus taught himself Latin and the rudiments of Greek. He was subjected to so much ill usage at home in consequence of this love of study that he determined to leave it. Demanding the patrimony which his father had left him, he proceeded to Treves, and assuming the name of Trithemius from that of his native village of Trithheim, lived there for some months under the tuition of eminent masters, by whom he was prepared for the university. At the age of 20, he took it into his head that he should like to see his mother once more, and he set out on foot from the distant university for that purpose. On his arrival near Spanheim, late in the evening of a gloomy winter's day, it came on to snow so thickly that he could not proceed onwards to the town. He therefore took refuge for the night in a neighboring monastery. But the storm continued several days, the roads became impassable, and the hospitable monks would not hear of his departure. He was so pleased with them and their manner of life that he suddenly resolved to fix his abode among them and renounce the world. They were no less pleased with him and gladly received him as a brother. In the course of 2 years, although still so young, he was unanimously elected their abbot. The financial affairs of the establishment had been greatly neglected. The walls of the building were falling into ruin and everything was in disorder. Trithemius, by his good management and regularity, introduced a reform in every branch of expenditure. The monastery was repaired, and a yearly surplus, instead of a deficiency, rewarded him for his pains. He did not like to see the monks idle or occupied solely between prayers for their business and chess for their relaxation. He therefore set them to work to copy the writings of eminent authors. They labored so assiduously that, in the course of a few years, their library, which had contained only about 40 volumes, was enriched with several hundred valuable manuscripts, comprising many of the classical Latin authors, besides the works of the early fathers and the principal historians and philosophers of more modern date. He retained the dignity of abbot of Spanheim for 21 years, when the monks, tired of the severe discipline he maintained, revolted against him and chose another abbot in his place. He was afterwards made abbot of St. James in Würzburg, where he died in 1516. During his learned leisure at Spanheim, he wrote several works upon the occult sciences, the chief of which are an essay on geomancy, or divination by means of lines and circles on the ground, another upon sorcery, a third upon alchemy, and a fourth upon the government of the world by its presiding angels, which was translated into English and published by the famous William Lilly in 1647. It has been alleged by the believers in the possibility of transmutation that the prosperity of the Abbey of Spanheim, while under his superintendence, was owing more to the philosopher's stone than to wise economy. Trithemius, in common with many other learned men, has been accused of magic. And a marvelous story is told of his having raised from the grave the form of Mary of Burgundy at the intercession of her widowed husband, the Emperor Maximilian. His work on steganographia, or cabalistic writing, was denounced to the Count Palatine, Frederick II, as magical and devilish, and it was by him taken from the shelves of his library and thrown into the fire. Trithemius is said to be the first writer who makes mention of the wonderful story of the devil and Dr. Faustus, the truth of which he firmly believed. He also recounts the freaks of a spirit named Houdican, by whom he was at times tormented. The Maréchal de Ray. One of the greatest encouragers of alchemy in the 15th century was Gilles de Laval, Lord of Ray and a Marshal of France. His name and deeds are little known, but in the annals of crime and folly they might claim the highest and worst preeminence. Fiction has never invented anything wilder or more horrible than his career, and were not the details but too well authenticated by legal and other documents, which admit no doubt, the lover of romance might easily imagine they were drawn to please him from the stores of the prolific brain, and not from the page of history. He was born about the year 1420 of one of the noblest families of Brittany. His father dying when Gilles had attained his 20th year, he came into uncontrolled possession at that early age of a fortune which the monarchs of France might have envied him. He was a near kinsman of the Montmorencys, the Rancys, and the Craons, possessed 15 princely domains, and had an annual revenue of about 300,000 livres. Besides this, he was handsome, learned, and brave. He distinguished himself greatly in the wars of Charles VII, and was rewarded by that monarch with the dignity of a Marshal of France. But he was extravagant and magnificent in his style of living, and accustomed from his earliest years to the gratification of every wish and passion. And this, at last, led him from vice to vice and from crime to crime, till a blacker name than his is not to be found in any record of human iniquity. In his castle of Chantoussée, he lived with all the splendor of an Eastern caliph. He kept up a troop of 200 horsemen to accompany him wherever he went, and his excursions for the purposes of hawking and hunting were the wonder of all the country around, so magnificent were the caparisons of his steeds and the dresses of his retainers. Day and night his castle was open all the year round to comers of every degree. He made it a rule to regale even the poorest beggar with wine and hypocras. Every day an ox was roasted whole in his spacious kitchens, besides sheep, pigs, and poultry sufficient to feed 500 persons. He was equally magnificent in his devotions. His private chapel at Chantoussée was the most beautiful in France, and far surpassed any of those in the richly endowed cathedrals of Notre-Dame in Paris, of Amiens, of Beauvais, or of Rouen. It was hung with cloth of gold and rich velvet. All the chandeliers were of pure gold, curiously inlaid with silver. The great crucifix over the altar was of solid silver, and the chalices and incense burners were of pure gold. He had, besides, a fine organ, which he caused to be carried from one castle to another on the shoulders of 6 men, whenever he changed his residence. He kept up a choir of 25 young children of both sexes, who were instructed in singing by the first musicians of the day. The master of his chapel he called a bishop, who had under him his deans, archdeacons, and vicars, each receiving great salaries, the bishop 400 crowns a year, and the rest in proportion. He also maintained a whole troop of players, including 10 dancing girls and as many ballad singers, besides morris dancers, jugglers, and mountebanks of every description. The theater on which they performed was fitted up without any regard to expense, and they played mysteries or danced the morris dance every evening for the amusement of himself and household, and such strangers as were sharing his prodigal hospitality. At the age of 23 he married Catherine, the wealthy heiress of the House of Thouars, for whom he refurnished his castle at an expense of 100,000 crowns. His marriage was the signal for new extravagance, and he launched out more madly than ever he had done before, sending for fine singers or celebrated dancers from foreign countries to amuse him and his spouse, and instituting tilts and tournaments in his great courtyard almost every week for all the knights and nobles of the province of Brittany. The Duke of Brittany's court was not half so splendid as that of the Maréchal de Ray. His utter disregard for wealth was so well known that he was made to pay 3 times its value for everything he purchased. His castle was filled with needy parasites and panderers to his pleasures, amongst whom he lavished rewards with an unsparing hand. But the ordinary round of sensual gratification ceased at last to afford him delight. He was observed to be more abstemious in the pleasures of the table, and to neglect the beauteous dancing girls who used formerly to occupy so much of his attention. He was sometimes gloomy and reserved, and there was an unnatural wildness in his eye which gave indications of incipient madness. Still, his discourse was as reasonable as ever, his urbanity to the guests that flocked from far and near to Chantoussée suffered no diminution, and learned priests, when they conversed with him, thought to themselves that few of the nobles of France were so well informed as Gilles de Laval. But dark rumors spread gradually over the country. Murder, and if possible, still more atrocious deeds were hinted at, and it was remarked that many young children of both sexes suddenly disappeared and were never afterwards heard of. One or two had been traced to the castle of Chantoussée and had never been seen to leave it, but no one dared to accuse openly so powerful a man as the Maréchal de Ray. Whenever the subject of the lost children was mentioned in his presence, he manifested the greatest astonishment at the mystery which involved their fate, and indignation against those who might be guilty of kidnapping them. Still, the world was not wholly deceived. His name became as formidable to young children as that of the devouring ogre in fairy tales, and they were taught to go miles round rather than pass under the turrets of Chantausée. In the course of a few years, the reckless extravagance of the marshal drained him of all his funds, and he was obliged to put up some of his estates for sale. The Duke of Brittany entered into a treaty with him for the valuable seigneury of Angrande, but the heirs of Gilles implored the interference of Charles VII to stay the sale. Charles immediately issued an edict, which was confirmed by the provincial parliament of Brittany, forbidding him to alienate his paternal estates. Gilles had no alternative but to submit. He had nothing to support his extravagance but his allowance as a marshal of France, which did not cover the one-tenth of his expenses. A man of his habits and character could not retrench his wasteful expenditure and live reasonably. He could not dismiss without a pang his horsemen, his jesters, his morris dancers, his choristers, and his parasites, or confine his hospitality to those who really needed it. Notwithstanding his diminished resources, he resolved to live as he had lived before and turn alchemist, that he might make gold out of iron and be still the wealthiest and most magnificent among the nobles of Brittany. In pursuance of this determination, he sent to Paris, Italy, Germany, and Spain, inviting all the adepts in the science to visit him at Chantausée. The messengers he dispatched on this mission were two of his most needy and unprincipled dependents, Gilles de Sillet and Roger de Briqueville. The latter, the obsequious panderer to his most secret and abominable pleasures, he had entrusted with the education of his motherless daughter, a child but 5 years of age, with permission that he might marry her at the proper time to any person he chose, or to himself if he liked it better. This man entered into the new plans of his master with great zeal, and introduced to him one Prelati, an alchemist of Padua, and a physician of Poitou, who was addicted to the same pursuits. The marshal caused a splendid laboratory to be fitted up for them, and the three commenced the search for the philosopher's stone. They were soon afterwards joined by another pretended philosopher named Anthony Palermo, who aided in their operations for upwards of a year. They all fared sumptuously at the marshal's expense, draining him of the ready money he possessed, and leading him on from day to day with the hope that they would succeed in the object of their search. From time to time, new aspirants from the remotest parts of Europe arrived at his castle, and for months he had upwards of 20 alchemists at work, trying to transmute copper into gold, and wasting the gold which was still his own in drugs and elixirs. But the Lord of Ray was not a man to abide patiently their lingering processes. Pleased with their comfortable quarters, they jogged on from day to day and would have done so for years had they been permitted. But he suddenly dismissed them all with the exception of the Italian Prelati and the physician of Poitou. These he retained to aid him to discover the secret of the philosopher's stone by a bolder method. The Poitousan had persuaded him that the devil was the great depository of that and all other secrets, and that he would raise him before Gilles, who might enter into any contract he pleased with him. Gilles expressed his readiness and promised to give the devil anything but his soul, or do any deed that the archenemy might impose upon him. Attended solely by the physician, he proceeded at midnight to a wild-looking place in a neighboring forest. The physician drew a magic circle around them on the sward, and muttered for half an hour an invocation to the evil spirit to arise at his bidding, and disclose the secrets of alchemy. Gilles looked on with intense interest, and expected every moment to see the earth open, and deliver to his gaze the great enemy of mankind. At last the eyes of the physician became fixed, his hair stood on end, and he spoke as if addressing the fiend. But Gilles saw nothing except his companion. At last the physician fell down on the sward as if insensible. Gilles looked calmly on to see the end. After a few minutes the physician arose and asked him if he had not seen how angry the devil looked. Gilles replied that he had seen nothing, upon which his companion informed him that Beelzebub had appeared in the form of a wild leopard growled at him savagely and said nothing, and that the reason why the marshal had neither seen nor heard him was that he hesitated in his own mind as to devoting himself entirely to the service. Duret owned that he had indeed misgivings, and inquired what was to be done to make the devil speak out and unfold his secret. The physician replied that some person must go to Spain and Africa to collect certain herbs which only grew in those countries, and offered to go himself if Duret would provide the necessary funds. Duret at once consented, and the physician set out on the following day with all the gold that his dupe could spare him. The marshal never saw his face again. But the eager lord of Chantausse could not rest. Gold was necessary for his pleasures, and unless by supernatural aid he had no means of procuring any further supplies. The physician was hardly 20 leagues on his journey before Gilles resolved to make another attempt to force the devil to divulge the art of gold-making. He went out alone for that purpose, but all his conjurations were of no effect. Beelzebub was obstinate and would not appear. Determined to conquer him if he could, he unbosomed himself to the Italian alchemist, Prelati. The latter offered to undertake the business upon condition that Duret did not interfere in the conjurations, and consented besides to furnish him with all the charms and talismans that might be required. He was further to open a vein in his arm and sign with his blood a contract that he would work the devil's will in all things, and offer up to him a sacrifice of the heart, lungs, hands, eyes, and blood of a young child. The grasping monomaniac made no hesitation, but agreed at once to the disgusting terms proposed to him. On the following night, Prelati went out alone, and after having been absent for 3 or 4 hours, returned to Gilles, who sat anxiously awaiting him. Prelati then informed him that he had seen the devil in the shape of a handsome youth of 20. He further said that the devil desired to be called Baron in all future invocations, and had shown him a great number of ingots of pure gold buried under a large oak in the neighboring forest, all of which, as many more as he desired, should become the property of the Maréchal de Ré if he remained firm and broke no condition of the contract. Prelati further showed him a small casket of black dust which would turn iron into gold. But as the process was very troublesome, he advised that they should be contented with the ingots they found under the oak tree, and which would more than supply all the wants that the most extravagant imagination could desire. They were not, however, to attempt to look for the gold till a period of 7 times 7 weeks, or they would find nothing but slates and stones for their pains. Gilles expressed the utmost chagrin and disappointment, and at once said that he could not wait for so long a period. If the devil were not more prompt, Prelati might tell him that the Maréchal de Ré was not to be trifled with, and would decline all further communication with him. Prelati at last persuaded him to wait 7 times 7 days. They then went at midnight with picks and shovels to dig up the ground under the oak, where they found nothing to reward them but a great quantity of slates, marked with hieroglyphics. It was now Prelati's turn to be angry, and he loudly swore that the devil was nothing but a liar and a cheat. The marshal joined cordially in the opinion, but was easily persuaded by the cunning Italian to make one more trial. He promised at the same time that he would endeavor on the following night to discover the reason why the devil had broken his word. He went out alone accordingly, and on his return informed his patron that he had seen Baron, who was exceedingly angry that they had not waited the proper time ere they looked for the ingots. Baron had also said that the Maréchal de Ré could hardly expect any favors from him at a time when he must know that he had been meditating a pilgrimage to the Holy Land to make atonement for his sins. The Italian had doubtless surmised this from some incautious expression of his patron, for de Ré frankly confessed that there were times when, sick of the world and all its pomps and vanities, he thought of devoting himself to the service of God. In this manner the Italian lured on from month to month his credulous and guilty patron, extracting from him all the valuables he possessed, and only waiting a favorable opportunity to decamp with his plunder. But the day of retribution was at hand for both. Young girls and boys continued to disappear in the most mysterious manner, and the rumors against the owner of Chantausse grew so loud and distinct that the church was compelled to interfere. Representations were made by the Bishop of Nantes to the Duke of Brittany that it would be a public scandal if the accusations against the Maréchal de Rais were not inquired into. He was arrested, accordingly, in his own castle, along with his accomplice, Prelati, and thrown into a dungeon at Nantes to await his trial. The judges appointed to try him were the Bishop of Nantes, Chancellor of Brittany, the Vicar of the Inquisition in France, and the celebrated Pierre L'Hôpital, the President of the Provincial Parliament. The offenses laid to his charge were sorcery, sodomy, and murder. Gilles, on the first day of his trial, conducted himself with the utmost insolence. He braved the judges on the judgment seat, calling them simoniacs and persons of impure life, and said he would rather be hanged by the neck like a dog without trial than plead either guilty or not guilty before such contemptible miscreants. But his confidence forsook him as the trial proceeded, and he was found guilty on the clearest evidence of all the crimes laid to his charge. It was proved that he took insane pleasure in stabbing the victims of his lust and in observing the quivering of their flesh and the fading luster of their eyes as they expired. The confession of Prelati first made the judges acquainted with this horrid madness, and Gilles himself confirmed it before his death. Nearly 100 children of the villagers around his two castles of Chantousset and Machecou had been missing within 3 years, the greater part, if not all of whom, were immolated to the lust or the cupidity of this monster. He imagined that he thus made the devil his friend, and that his recompense would be the secret of the philosopher's stone. Gilles and Prelati were both condemned to be burned alive. At the place of execution, they assumed the air of penitence and religion. Gilles tenderly embraced Prelati, saying, "Farewell, friend Francis. In this world we shall never meet again, but let us place our hopes in God. We shall see each other in paradise." Out of consideration for his high rank and connections, the punishment of the marshal was so far mitigated that he was not burned alive like Prelati. He was first strangled and then thrown into the flames. His body, when half consumed, was given over to his relatives for interment, while that of the Italian was burned to ashes and then scattered to the winds. For full details of this extraordinary trial, see Lobineau's Nouvelle Histoire de Bretagne and D'Argentré's work on the same subject. The character and life of Gilles de Rais are believed to have suggested the famous Bluebeard of the nursery tale. Jacques Coeur. This remarkable pretender to the secret of the philosopher's stone was contemporary with the last mentioned. He was a great personage at the court of Charles VII, and in the events of his reign played a prominent part. From a very humble origin, he rose to the highest honors of the state and amassed enormous wealth by peculation and plunder of the country which he should have served. It was to hide his delinquencies in this respect and to divert attention from the real source of his riches that he boasted of having discovered the art of transmuting the inferior metals into gold and silver. His father was a goldsmith in the city of Bourges, but so reduced in circumstances toward the latter years of his life that he was unable to pay the necessary fees to procure his son's admission into the guild. Young Jacques became, however, a workman in the Royal Mint of Bourges in 1428, and behaved himself so well and showed so much knowledge of metallurgy that he attained rapid promotion in that establishment. He had also the good fortune to make the acquaintance of the fair Agnes Sorel, by whom he was patronized and much esteemed. Jacques had now three things in his favor: ability, perseverance, and the countenance of the king's mistress. Many a man succeeds with but one of these to help him forward, and it would have been strange indeed if Jacques Coeur, who had them all, should have languished in obscurity. While still a young man, he was made master of the mint in which he had been a journeyman, and installed at the same time into the vacant office of Grand Treasurer of the Royal Household. He possessed an extensive knowledge of finance and turned it wonderfully to his own advantage as soon as he became entrusted with extensive funds. He speculated in articles of the first necessity and made himself popular by buying up grain, honey, wines, and other produce, till there was a scarcity, when he sold it again at enormous profit. Strong in the royal favor, he did not hesitate to oppress the poor by continual acts of forestalling and monopoly. As there is no enemy so bitter as the estranged friend, so of all the tyrants and tramplers upon the poor, there is none so fierce and reckless as the upstart that sprang from their ranks. The offensive pride of Jacques Coeur to his inferiors was the theme of indignant reproach in his own city, and his cringing humility to those above him was as much an object of contempt to the aristocrats into whose society he thrust himself. But Jacques did not care for the former, and to the latter he was blind. He continued his career till he became the richest man in France, and so useful to the king that no important enterprise was set on foot until he had been consulted. He was sent in 1446 on an embassy to Genoa, and in the following year to Pope Nicholas V. In both these missions he acquitted himself to the satisfaction of his sovereign, and was rewarded with a lucrative appointment, in addition to those which he already held. In the year 1449, the English in Normandy, deprived of their great general, the Duke of Bedford, broke the truce with the French king and took possession of a small town belonging to the Duke of Brittany. This was the signal for the recommencement of a war, in which the French regained possession of nearly the whole province. The money for this war was advanced, for the most part, by Jacques Coeur. When Rouen yielded to the French, and Charles made his triumphant entry into that city, accompanied by Dunois and his most famous generals, Jacques was among the most brilliant of his cortege. His chariot and horses vied with those of the king in the magnificence of their trappings, and his enemies said of him that he publicly boasted that he alone had driven out the English, and that the valor of the troops would have been nothing without his gold. Dunois appears also to have been partly of the same opinion. Without disparaging the courage of the army, he acknowledged the utility of the able financier, by whose means they had been fed and paid, and constantly afforded him his powerful protection. When peace returned, Jacques again devoted himself to commerce and fitted up several galleys to trade with the Genoese. He also bought large estates in various parts of France, the chief of which were the baronies of Saint-Fargeau, Meneton, Salon, Maubranche, Meon, Saint-Gérand-de-Vaux, and Saint-Aon de Boissy, the earldoms or counties of La Palisse, Champignel, Beaumont, and Villeneuve-le-Genêt, and the Marquisate of Toussy. He also procured for his son, Jean Coeur, who had chosen the church for his profession, a post no less distinguished than that of Archbishop of Bourges. Everybody said that so much wealth could not have been honestly acquired, and both rich and poor longed for the day that should humble the pride of the man, whom the one class regarded as an upstart and the other as an oppressor. Jacques was somewhat alarmed at the rumors that were afloat respecting him, and of dark hints that he had debased the coin of the realm and forged the king's seal to an important document, by which he had defrauded the state of very considerable sums. To silence these rumors, he invited many alchemists from foreign countries to reside with him, and circulated a counter-rumor that he had discovered the secret of the philosopher's stone. He also built a magnificent house in his native city, over the entrance of which he caused to be sculptured the emblems of that science. Sometime afterwards he built another, no less splendid, at Montpellier, which he inscribed in a similar manner. He also wrote a treatise upon the Hermetic philosophy, in which he pretended that he knew the secret of transmuting metals. But all these attempts to disguise his numerous acts of peculation proved unavailing, and he was arrested in 1452 and brought to trial on several charges. Upon one only, which the malice of his enemies invented to ruin him, was he acquitted, which was that he had been accessory to the death by poison of his kind patroness, Agnes Sorel. Upon the others he was found guilty and sentenced to be banished the kingdom and to pay the enormous fine of 400,000 crowns. It was proved that he had forged the king's seal, that in his capacity of master of the Mint of Bourges he had debased to a very great extent the gold and silver coin of the realm, and that he had not hesitated to supply the Turks with arms and money to enable them to carry on war against their Christian neighbors, for which service he had received the most munificent recompenses. Charles VII was deeply grieved at his condemnation and believed to the last that he was innocent. By his means, the fine was reduced within a sum which Jacques Coeur could pay. After remaining for some time in prison, he was liberated and left France with a large sum of money, part of which, it was alleged, was secretly paid him by Charles out of the produce of his confiscated estates. He retired to Cyprus, where he died about 1460, the richest and most conspicuous personage of the island. The writers upon alchemy all claim Jacques Coeur as a member of their fraternity, and treat as false and libelous the more rational explanation of his wealth which the records of his trial afford. Pierre Borel, in his Antiquité Gauloise, maintains the opinion that Jacques was an honest man, and that he made his gold out of lead and copper by means of the philosopher's stone. The alchemic adepts in general were of the same opinion, but they found it difficult to persuade even his contemporaries of the fact. Posterity is still less likely to believe it. Inferior adepts of the 14th and 15th centuries. Many other pretenders to the secrets of the philosopher's stone appeared in every country in Europe during the 14th and 15th centuries. The possibility of transmutation was so generally admitted that every chemist was more or less an alchemist. Germany, Holland, Italy, Spain, Poland, France, and England produced thousands of obscure adepts who supported themselves in the pursuit of their chimera by the more profitable resources of astrology and divination. The monarchs of Europe were no less persuaded than their subjects of the possibility of discovering the philosopher's stone. Henry VI and Edward IV of England encouraged alchemy. In Germany, the emperors Maximilian, Rudolf, and Frederick II devoted much of their attention to it. And every inferior potentate within their dominions imitated their example. It was a common practice in Germany among the nobles and petty sovereigns to invite an alchemist to take up his residence among them, that they might confine him in a dungeon till he made gold enough to pay millions for his ransom. Many poor wretches suffered perpetual imprisonment in consequence. A similar fate appears to have been intended by Edward II for Raymond Lully, who, upon the pretense that he was thereby honored, was accommodated with apartments in the Tower of London. He found out in time the trick that was about to be played him, and managed to make his escape, some of his biographers say by jumping into the Thames and swimming to a vessel that lay waiting to receive him. In the 16th century, the same system was pursued, as will be shown more fully in the life of Seton the Cosmopolite. The following is a catalogue of the chief authors upon alchemy who flourished during this epoch, and whose lives and adventures are either unknown or are unworthy of more detailed notice. John Dowston, an Englishman, lived in 1315 and wrote two treatises on the philosopher's stone. Richard, or as some call him, Robert, also an Englishman, lived in 1330 and wrote a work entitled Correctorium Alchumiae, which was much esteemed till the time of Paracelsus. In the same year lived Peter of Lombardy, who wrote what he called a complete treatise upon the hermetic science, an abridgment of which was afterwards published by Lacini, a monk of Calabria. In 1330, the most famous alchemist of Paris was one Odomer, whose work, De Practica Magistri, was for a long time a handbook among the brethren of the science. John de Rupacissa, a French monk of the Order of St. Francis, flourished in 1357 and pretended to be a prophet as well as an alchemist. Some of his prophecies were so disagreeable to Pope Innocent VI that the pontiff determined to put a stop to them by locking up the prophet in the dungeons of the Vatican. It is generally believed that he died there, though there is no evidence of the fact. His chief works are The Book of Light, The Five Essences, The Heaven of Philosophers, and his grand work, De Confectione Lapidis. He was not thought a shining light among the adepts. Ortholani was another pretender, of whom nothing is known but that he exercised the arts of alchemy and astrology at Paris, shortly before the time of Nicolas Flamel. His work on the practice of alchemy was written in that city in 1358. Isaac of Holland wrote, it is supposed, about this time, and his son also devoted himself to the science. Nothing worth repeating is known of their lives. Boerhaave speaks with commendation of many passages in their works, and Paracelsus esteemed them highly. The chief are De Triplici Ordine Elixiris et Lapidis Theoria, printed at Bern in 1608, and Mineralia Opera, Seu de Lapide Philosophico, printed at Middleburg in 1600. They also wrote eight other works upon the same subject. Koftsky, a Pole, wrote an alchemical treatise entitled The Tincture of Minerals about the year 1488. In this list of authors, a royal name must not be forgotten, Charles VI of France, one of the most credulous princes of the day, whose court absolutely swarmed with alchemists, conjurers, astrologers, and quacks of every description, made several attempts to discover the philosopher's stone, and thought he knew so much about it that he determined to enlighten the world with a treatise. It is called The Royal Work of Charles VI of France and The Treasure of Philosophy. It is said to be the original from which Nicolas Flamel took the idea of his Désir Désiré. Longlet Dufresnois says it is very allegorical and utterly incomprehensible. For a more complete list of the Hermetic philosophers of the 14th and 15th centuries, the reader is referred to the third volume of Longlet's History, already quoted. Progress of the infatuation during the 16th and 17th centuries, present state of the science. During the 16th and 17th centuries, the search for the philosopher's stone was continued by thousands of the enthusiastic and the credulous. But a great change was introduced during this period. The eminent men who devoted themselves to the study totally changed its aspect, and referred to the possession of their wondrous stone and elixir, not only the conversion of the base into the precious metals, but the solution of all the difficulties of other sciences. They pretended that by its means man would be brought into closer communion with his Maker, that disease and sorrow would be banished from the world, and that the millions of spiritual beings who walk the earth unseen would be rendered visible and become the friends, companions, and instructors of mankind. In the 17th century, more especially, these poetical and fantastic doctrines excited the notice of Europe, and from Germany, where they had been first disseminated by Rosenkreutz, spread into France and England, and ran away with the sound judgment of many clever but too enthusiastic searchers for the truth. Paracelsus, Dee, and many others of less note were captivated by the grace and beauty of the new mythology, which was arising to adorn the literature of Europe. Most of the alchemists of the 16th century, although ignorant of the Rosicrucians as a sect, were, in some degree, tinctured with their fanciful tenets. But before we speak more fully of these poetical visionaries, it will be necessary to resume the history of the Hermetic folly and trace the gradual change that stole over the dreams of the adepts. It will be seen that the infatuation increased rather than diminished as the world grew older. Augurello. Among the alchemists who were born in the 15th and distinguished themselves in the 16th century, the first in point of date is John Aurelio Augurello. He was born at Rimini in 1441 and became professor of the Belles Lettres at Venice and Trevisa. He was early convinced of the truth of the Hermetic science and used to pray to God that he might be happy enough to discover the philosopher's stone. He was continually surrounded by the paraphernalia of chemistry and expended all his wealth in the purchase of drugs and metals. He was also a poet, but of less merit than pretensions. His Chrysopoeia, in which he pretended to teach the art of making gold, he dedicated to Pope Leo X, in the hope that the pontiff would reward him handsomely for the compliment. But the pope was too good a judge of poetry to be pleased with the worse than mediocrity of his poem, and too good a philosopher to approve of the strange doctrines which it inculcated. He was, therefore, far from gratified at the dedication. It is said that when Augurello applied to him for a reward, the pope, with great ceremony and much apparent kindness and cordiality, drew an empty purse from his pocket and presented it to the alchemist, saying that since he was able to make gold, the most appropriate present that could be made him was a purse to put it in. This scurvy reward was all that the poor alchemist ever got either for his poetry or his alchemy. He died in a state of extreme poverty in the 83rd year of his age. Cornelius Agrippa. This alchemist has left a distinguished reputation. The most extraordinary tales were told and believed of his powers. He could turn iron into gold by his mere word. All the spirits of the air and demons of the earth were under his command, and bound to obey him in everything. He could raise from the dead the forms of the great men of other days, and make them appear in their habit as they lived, to the gaze of the curious who had courage enough to abide their presence. He was born at Cologne in 1486, and began at an early age the study of chemistry and philosophy. By some means or other, which have never been very clearly explained, he managed to impress his contemporaries with a great idea of his wonderful attainments. At the early age of 20, so great was his reputation as an alchemist that the principal adepts of Paris wrote to Cologne, inviting him to settle in France, and aid them with his experience in discovering the philosopher's stone. Honors poured upon him in thick succession, and he was highly esteemed by all the learned men of his time. Melanchthon speaks of him with respect and commendation. Erasmus also bears testimony in his favor, and the general voice of his age proclaimed him a light of literature and an ornament to philosophy. Some men, by dint of excessive egotism, manage to persuade their contemporaries that they are very great men indeed. They publish their acquirements so loudly in people's ears and keep up their own praises so incessantly that the world's applause is actually taken by storm. Such seems to have been the case with Agrippa. He called himself a sublime theologian, an excellent jurisconsult, an able physician, a great philosopher, and a successful alchemist. The world at last took him at his word, and thought that a man who talked so big must have some merit to recommend him, that it was indeed a great trumpet which sounded so obstreperous a blast. He was made secretary to the Emperor Maximilian, who conferred upon him the title of chevalier and gave him the honorary command of a regiment. He afterwards became professor of Hebrew and the Belles Lettres at the University of Dole in France. But quarreling with the Franciscan monks upon some knotty points of divinity, he was obliged to quit the town. He took refuge in London, where he taught Hebrew and cast nativities, for about a year. From London he proceeded to Pavia, and gave lectures upon the writings, real or supposed, of Hermes Trismegistus, and might have lived there in peace and honor had he not again quarreled with the clergy. By their means his position became so disagreeable that he was glad to accept an offer made him by the magistracy of Metz to become their syndic and advocate general. Here again his love of disputation made him enemies. The theological wiseacres of that city asserted that St. Anne had three husbands, in which opinion they were confirmed by the popular belief of the day. Agrippa needlessly ran foul of this opinion, or prejudice as he called it, and thereby lost much of his influence. Another dispute, more creditable to his character, occurred soon after, and sank him forever in the estimation of the Metzians. Humanely taking the part of a young girl who was accused of witchcraft, his enemies asserted that he was himself a sorcerer, and raised such a storm over his head that he was forced to fly the city. After this he became physician to Louisa de Savoie, mother of King Francis I. This lady was curious to know the future and required her physician to cast her nativity. Agrippa replied that he would not encourage such idle curiosity. The result was he lost her confidence and was forthwith dismissed. If it had been through his belief in the worthlessness of astrology that he had made his answer, we might admire his honest and fearless independence. But when it is known that at the very same time he was in the constant habit of divination and fortune-telling, and that he was predicting splendid success in all his undertakings to the Constable of Bourbon, we can only wonder at his thus estranging a powerful friend through mere petulance and perversity. He was about this time invited both by Henry VIII of England and Margaret of Austria, governess of the Low Countries, to fix his residence in their dominions. He chose the service of the latter, by whose influence he was made historiographer to the Emperor Charles V. Unfortunately for Agrippa, he never had stability enough to remain long in one position, and offended his patrons by his restlessness and presumption. After the death of Margaret, he was imprisoned at Brussels on a charge of sorcery. He was released after a year, and quitting the country, experienced many vicissitudes. He died in great poverty in 1534, aged 48 years. While in the service of Margaret of Austria, he resided principally at Louvain, in which city he wrote his famous work on the vanity and nothingness of human knowledge. He also wrote, to please his royal mistress, a treatise upon the superiority of the female sex, which he dedicated to her in token of his gratitude for the favors she had heaped upon him. The reputation he left behind him in these provinces was anything but favorable. A great number of the marvelous tales that are told of him relate to this period of his life. It was said that the gold which he paid to the traders with whom he dealt always looked remarkably bright, but invariably turned into pieces of slate and stone in the course of 24 hours. Of this spurious gold he was believed to have made large quantities by the aid of the devil, who, it would appear from this, had but a very superficial knowledge of alchemy, and much less than the Maréchal de Ray gave him credit for. The Jesuit Del Rio, in his book on magic and sorcery, relates a still more extraordinary story of him. One day Agrippa left his house at Louvain, and, intending to be absent for some time, gave the key of his study to his wife, with strict orders that no one should enter it during his absence. The lady herself, strange as it may appear, had no curiosity to pry into her husband's secrets, and never once thought of entering the forbidden room. But a young student, who had been accommodated with an attic in the philosopher's house, burned with a fierce desire to examine the study. Hoping, perchance, that he might purloin some book or implement which would instruct him in the art of transmuting metals. The youth, being handsome, eloquent, and above all highly complimentary to the charms of the lady, she was persuaded without much difficulty to lend him the key, but gave him strict orders not to remove anything. The student promised implicit obedience and entered Agrippa's study. The first object that caught his attention was a large grimoire, or book of spells, which lay open on the philosopher's desk. He sat himself down immediately and began to read. At the first word he uttered, he fancied he heard a knock at the door. He listened, but all was silent. Thinking that his imagination had deceived him, he read on, when immediately a louder knock was heard, which so terrified him that he started to his feet. He tried to say, "Come in," but his tongue refused its office, and he could not articulate a sound. He fixed his eyes upon the door, which, slowly opening, disclosed a stranger of majestic form but scowling features, who demanded sternly why he was summoned. "I did not summon you," said the trembling student. "You did," said the stranger, advancing angrily, "and the demons are not to be invoked in vain." The student could make no reply, and the demon, enraged that one of the uninitiated should have summoned him out of mere presumption, seized him by the throat and strangled him. When Agrippa returned a few days afterwards, he found his house beset with devils. Some of them were sitting on the chimney pots, kicking up their legs in the air, while others were playing at leapfrog on the very edge of the parapet. His study was so filled with them that he found it difficult to make his way to his desk. When at last he had elbowed his way through them, he found his book open and the student lying dead upon the floor. He saw immediately how the mischief had been done, and dismissing all the inferior imps, asked the principal demon how he could have been so rash as to kill the young man. The demon replied that he had been needlessly invoked by an insulting youth and could do no less than kill him for his presumption. Agrippa reprimanded him severely and ordered him immediately to reanimate the dead body and walk about with it in the marketplace for the whole of the afternoon. The demon did so. The student revived and, putting his arm through that of his unearthly murderer, walked very lovingly with him in sight of all the people. At sunset the body fell down again, cold and lifeless as before, and was carried by the crowd to the hospital, it being the general opinion that he had expired in a fit of apoplexy. His conductor immediately disappeared. When the body was examined, marks of strangulation were found on the neck, and prints of the long claws of the demon on various parts of it. These appearances, together with a story which soon obtained currency that the companion of the young man had vanished in a cloud of flame and smoke, opened people's eyes to the truth. The magistrates of Louvain instituted inquiries, and the result was that Agrippa was obliged to quit the town. Other authors besides Del Rio relate similar stories of this philosopher. The world in those days was always willing enough to believe in tales of magic and sorcery. And when, as in Agrippa's case, the alleged magician gave himself out for such and claimed credit for the wonders he worked, it is not surprising that the age should have allowed his pretensions. It was dangerous boasting, which sometimes led to the stake or the gallows, and therefore was thought to be not without foundation. Paulus Jovius, in his Eulogia Doctorum Virorum, says that the devil, in the shape of a large black dog, attended Agrippa wherever he went. Thomas Nash, in his Adventures of Jack Wilton, relates that, at the request of Lord Surrey, Erasmus, and some other learned men, Agrippa called up from the grave many of the great philosophers of antiquity. Among others, Tully, whom he caused to re-deliver his celebrated oration for Roscius. He also showed Lord Surrey, when in Germany, an exact resemblance in a glass of his mistress, the fair Geraldine. She was represented on a couch, weeping for the absence of her lover. Lord Surrey made a note of the exact time at which he saw this vision, and ascertained afterwards that his mistress was actually so employed at the very minute. To Thomas Lord Cromwell, Agrippa represented King Henry VIII hunting in Windsor Park with the principal lords of his court. And to please the Emperor Charles V, he summoned King David and King Solomon from the tomb. Naudet, in his Apology for the Great Men Who Have Been Falsely Suspected of Magic, takes a great deal of pains to clear Agrippa from the imputations cast upon him by Del Rio, Paulus Jovius, and other such ignorant and prejudiced scribblers. Such stories demanded refutation in the days of Naudet, but they may now be safely left to decay in their own absurdity. That they should have attached, however, to the memory of a man who claimed the power of making iron obey him when he told it to become gold, and who wrote such a work as that upon magic, which goes by his name, is not at all surprising. Paracelsus. This philosopher, called by Naudet the zenith and rising sun of all the alchemists, was born at Einsiedeln, near Zurich, in the year 1493. His true name was Hohenheim, to which, as he himself informs us, were prefixed the baptismal names of Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastes Paracelsus. The last of these he chose for his common designation while he was yet a boy, and rendered it, before he died, one of the most famous in the annals of his time. His father, who was a physician, educated his son for the same pursuit. The latter was an apt scholar and made great progress. By chance, the work of Isaac Hollandus fell into his hands, and from that time he became smitten with the mania of the philosopher's stone. All his thoughts henceforth were devoted to metallurgy, and he traveled into Sweden that he might visit the mines of that country and examine the ores while they yet lay in the bowels of the earth. He also visited Trithemius at the monastery of Spanheim, and obtained instructions from him in the science of alchemy. Continuing his travels, he proceeded through Prussia and Austria into Turkey, Egypt, and Tartary, and thence, returning to Constantinople, learned, as he boasted, the art of transmutation, and became possessed of the elixir vitae. He then established himself as a physician in his native Switzerland at Zurich, and commenced writing works upon alchemy and medicine, which immediately fixed the attention of Europe. Their great obscurity was no impediment to their fame, for the less the author was understood, the more the demonologists, fanatics, and philosophers, stone hunters, seemed to appreciate him. His fame as a physician kept pace with that which he enjoyed as an alchemist, owing to his having effected some happy cures by means of mercury and opium, drugs unceremoniously condemned by his professional brethren. In the year 1526, he was chosen professor of physics and natural philosophy in the University of Basel, where his lectures attracted vast numbers of students. He denounced the writings of all former physicians as tending to mislead, and publicly burned the works of Galen and Avicenna as quacks and impostors. He exclaimed in presence of the admiring and half-bewildered crowd who assembled to witness the ceremony that there was more knowledge in his shoestrings than in the writings of these physicians. Continuing in the same strain, he said all the universities in the world were full of ignorant quacks, but that he, Paracelsus, overflowed with wisdom. "You will all follow my new system," said he with furious gesticulations. "Avicenna, Galen,